I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And we have the podcast Office Ladies. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories and lots of laughs.
Follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
He turned into a pizza.
That's the stupidest thing you've ever said, Murph. And you said a lot of stupid shit.
Dottie, with her pungent Massachusetts accent and her lingering hangover, walked up to inspect the wall covered in black ash, staring up at it in complete bewilderment. She took off her Dorset Police Department sergeant's hat, wiped some lingering hangover sweat off her forehead, and tried to make sense of what the hell she was looking at, until the smell hit her.
Jesus Christmas, that is rancid, Dottie said, covering her nose as flashlights from a nearby forensics team member snapped photos.
Murph walked up behind Dottie, in his police uniform, shaking his head.
I don't know how else to say it, Sarge. It's like Mr. Sims was put in the oven and got cooked. Ash on the wall and an outline on the torso. And below the mantle, all along the floorboards, we got skin. Human skin, Sarge. I never seen anything like. I never heard of anything like it either. And I've heard of a lot of sick shit, Sarge.
Murph wiped the sweat off his forehead. He was 25 with a newborn and another one on the way. Things had been the definition of pleasant for Murph until this morning, when he was first on the scene to see what Bill Sims looked like now.
Don't I know it, Dottie said, kneeling down to get a better look at this long string of human skin running parallel to the floor below where the black ash was painted onto the wall.
Bizarre was an understatement. Yesterday, she was settling a dispute between two neighbors over recycling. Mrs. Truppiano said that Mrs. Shorkey had been leaving her Diet Cokes inside her blue recycling bin.
Mrs. Shorkey denies ever drinking a Diet Coke. Mrs. Truppiano showed picture proof of Mrs. Shorkey drinking a Diet Coke at the Condor Christmas party last year.
That was Dottie's day yesterday. It was one of several reasons she felt obligated to hit up Davy's dive bar after her shift ended and knock back 7 too many whiskeys.
You don't think it's... I mean, it was definitely, not a...
Spit it out, Murph.
Mida?
Murph's voice cracked as he said murder, like a young boy going through puberty. His knees buckled as he kneeled down next to Dottie.
We haven't had a murder in this town since 1985, Murph said, petrified by the thought of a murder in his idyllic hometown.
Murph had grown up here. Everyone had grown up here. It was the definition of quaint. If the winters weren't snow-ridden, this would have become a destination spot years ago. Luckily, the snow has kept it low-key and affordable. 1985, Dottie. That's almost 30 years.
And that was Cat on Man.
Dottie and Murph turned, staring at the forensic photographer Marty. Huge, black-rimmed glasses, wearing one of his infamous, in his mind at least, vintage Hawaiian shirts, cargo shorts, and custom-designed snow boots. Marty was approaching 50, but never really graduated past 13. He was routinely dressed down. His self-appointed superpower was the ability to always be extremely underdressed for the weather, hence the Hawaiian shirts. He could spin any conversation back to Batman and the DC Universe. Shockingly, this had a negative effect on his dating life, yet he always remained upbeat, as if someone had surgically implanted a large iced coffee up his ass.
Cat on Man? Murph asked. Look it up. Mrs. Crandall was going to get her mail. When she bent down to open the mail slot, her cat bit her finger from the other slot of the slot. Mrs. Crandall got startled, fell backwards, and cracked her head open. Cat on Man. Well, woman.
Dottie shook her head. It was bad enough she now had a potential murder case that made zero sense, but she was also surrounded by people talking about men becoming pizza and cats killing old ladies. She paced around this living room, scratching her aching head. Her knee hurt. She was barely 45 and already had bad knees. Making it worse, she didn't know why they hurt. It wasn't like she was playing softball and slid into second base. Or she was jogging past a creek. Or she fell out of bed while going down on Kathy's stoops. Nope. She just woke up one day and her knees started hurting. Kathy Stoops told her to go see a doctor. So did Dottie's mom. But Dottie ignored them.
It'll pass, she said. Only it hadn't, and that was 3 weeks ago. Focus on this dick shit of a case, Dottie thought. Get your mind out of your knees. So she did.
There were no signs of arson. Not that she had ever investigated an arson crime before, but any Joe off the street could see that this was not arson. The rest of the room was untouched. The rest of the house was untouched. Nothing was burnt. Just an outline of what used to be Mr. Sims up on the wall and along the floor.
How the hell was that possible? Did someone bring Mr. Sims and his various states of dismemberment and just leave it here for us to find?
There were no other prints in the house, just Sims. Whoever did this must have floated inside because they couldn't even see footprints.
Worst of all, icing on the shit sundae?
This hangover was long from over.
It was just the beginning. Dottie had a long fucking day ahead of her.
It felt inevitable.
That wasn't just Ryan Sims talking. That was all the guys in his construction crew talking. They were going to elevate these homes in the shoreline. The homes that everyone and their mother would have died to have. They were going to elevate these homes so that the next time there was a hurricane, they'd be able to weather the storm. Literally. But it felt inevitable that the storms would only get bigger and more powerful until one day, they just have to move their homes. So why bother?
Because the government gave them a big fat cash grant load, that's why.
Help the shoreline, keep their shore houses. God forbid we put that money towards the poor people. Like him. Like his family. Or maybe he was just still hungover. Maybe a big steaming coffee and a BLT would make him see the light. He tried. And it did. Suddenly helping these rich pricks elevate the foundation of their homes didn't seem half bad if it meant a steady paycheck. Half of which was going towards alimony. His kids. Gotta think of it as his kids, not alimony. Alimony sounds so sleazy.
Sleazy cause it is sleazy,
he remembered saying last night at Dive 85 after the fourth round of whiskeys. Or was it the fifth round? At that point, it's all a blur. Ryan Sims was nearing 40, gruff with the beard to match. He was built stocky and strong, with a crew cut to round out his rugged demeanor. He had a scar that went up from his left eyebrow towards his receding hairline.
You should see the other scars,
was a frequent pickup line that worked more than you think. Unless you lived in Dorset. In which case, it worked just as often as you might think.
Hey, Ryan!
Ryan turned. The foreman was standing next to the porta-potty alongside Dottie and Murphy. The crew all turned to look at Ryan as his heart sank. His gut pitted. His head pounded. The foreman waved Ryan over. Ryan got off the steel beam and jumped down to the ground, walking over towards Dottie while taking off his hard hat.
What's up, Dottie?
Hey, Ry. Can we chat in Dougie's office for a minute?
There was a brief pause.
Dottie, if it's all the same, I really like Dougie's office. Right now, I kind of think it's a happy place where I can share a stogie or a beer after a long week. So if you're gonna hit me with something heavy, I'd rather do it out here so Dougie's office can stay Dougie's office.
Dottie nodded. She understood. She had been in a similar situation on the other end and given a similar answer.
Your brother is dead, Ry.
Ryan turned, looking away, shook his head real quick once and then twice.
Nah, that... I just saw Billy. He's... That must be a mistake, Dottie.
I'm afraid not, Ry. There was another long pause. Denial. This was the first step in the seven stages.
No, you... You must have found the wrong guy. Billy...
Murph cut him off.
I'm sorry, Ry.
I'm... Murph stopped himself, coughing. Coughing to stop himself from tearing up. Murph walked away rather than embarrass himself. He was a softie, which had never mattered until now. In fact, his softness made him a beloved town cop. Ryan just nodded. He finally broke the long silence with a question.
Who did it?
Semi was a prick. Is that nice, Nick? Speaking that way of the deceased?
Stacy said from behind the bar.
Was Simi nice?
No.
He was a prick, Stacy, you know that. That don't mean he should have been burned alive,
she responded while pouring a refill. This was the typical tone of conversation coursing through Dive 85. A local favorite, especially during the playoffs of either baseball, basketball, football, or hockey. So, basically all year round, Dive 85 had a crowd. It was cozy and filled with animated conversation that would have been more accurately described by an outsider as an argument. Fortunately, outsiders never came into Dive 85. Outsiders never came into Dorset. It was called 85 because it was located on 85 Hamilton Avenue. Younger locals liked to joke that it was called Dive 85 because everyone inside was 85 or older. But the younger crowd loved it. It was a rite of passage. Soon, you will take your seat of your father or mother from Dive 85, and then you'll pass along your seat to your own children. And so it went, round and round through the circle of life and light beer.
Would you stop, please? Burnt alive. Lime, would you make her stop, please?
Lime sat quietly at the bar as Stacy gave him a refill. Lime stared off, watching the Red Sox try not to blow a 3-1 lead to the Royals in the bottom of the eighth. He was sure they were going to blow it. They had blown a 4-1 lead two nights ago, and this had a similar vibe to it.
Lime knows I'm right. Right, Con? Leave Lime out of it. You're the one bringing Lime into it.
Stacy and Nick routinely argued about seemingly everything. It was fodder for the patrons, as was their romantic relationship, which seemed to be on again, off again, going on 20 years. They loved to hate each other, and they hated loving each other. It was beautiful. For everyone else.
Simi was an old prick who left the gas on, lit a stogie, and it went up in flames. Same thing happened to my second cousin in Myrtle Beach. What are you swinging at?
Nick would occasionally interrupt himself by yelling at the TV, at which point his heart would skip 5 or 6 beats.
Lime, would you set Nick straight, please? Set me straight on what? What, Stacy? Set me straight on what? Simi lit up like a Christmas tree, but the rest of his house didn't get burnt? You tell me how that's possible. You tell me, Nick.
Spontaneous combustion.
That random bit of interference was provided by Susie Orwasher, approaching 90. She sipped her gin and tonic slowly while her eyes stayed fixed on the TV screen.
Spontaneous what now?
Nick asked.
You leave Susie alone, Nick. What'd I say to Susie?
Nick asked loudly.
You know what you said. What'd I say? You know what you said.
Good night.
Lime said softly as he left a $20 bill on the bar counter before putting on his big winter hat, wrapping a scarf around his neck, and heading out of Dive 85.
You made Lime leave. You happy now? I made him leave!
Lime heard them arguing in their romantic way as he stepped out into the parking lot. His breath shot out of his mouth as he carefully walked through, avoiding any patches of black ice. The last thing Lime needed was another fall. His hip survived the last time he fell, but that was nearly 10 years ago. There's a big difference between 73 and 63 years old. He knew that, which was why he was so careful about his steps through the parking lot. The light dusting of snow had already covered his 2000 Toyota Camry, a modest car for a modest man. He popped his trunk, took out his wiper, and gave it a quick once-over so that his windshield wipers could do the rest. Beyond him hitting his 2-drink minimum and the comfort of redundancy of Dive 85's robust conversations, there was another reason Lime wanted to leave when he did. He hated police talk. He had been on the force for nearly 40 years. The day he turned 18, he joined. And for 40 years, it was his life. Everything began and ended through the badge. He lived and breathed police. He took pride in it. Small-town problems was slander in Lime's eyes. Small-town generosity. Small-town manners, small-town respect, that was more like it. The idea of big-city police work always rubbed Lime the wrong way.
If you need a badge to make your pecker feel bigger, you're in the wrong line of work.
That was Lime's standard when addressing a new class of cops at the academy.
We are here to serve the people. Give, and you shall receive.
Lime believed that. He drove out of the parking lot and through the quiet streets. He would glance from right to left, still feeling a sense of duty. Part of him, deep down, probably wished he would see something. Something to make him feel alive again. Like those decades of walking the streets, being a beacon of public service. But that was all a small part of him. The bigger part of him relished being retired. He could leave Dive 85 and not worry about having to get up early. He could get up when he wanted. His schedule was exactly that. His schedule. By the time he got home, he could catch the final out. The Red Sox had held on. For a nightcap, Lime loved to watch the postgame show. He liked it more than the games sometimes. It was how he fell asleep most nights, on his recliner, with a glass of ice water by his side, and his dog, Cody, a German Shepherd, chewing on a bone by his feet. This night was like most every other night of Lime's retirement. That was just fine by him. Rinse and repeat. He loved it. He had looked forward to it. Except on this night, Lime couldn't fall asleep. He knew why. Sims. How the hell would someone burn alive while the rest of his house wasn't burnt? The physics didn't make sense. It wasn't on him to figure out why. He passed that duty on to the next line of police. Still, he couldn't help but wonder, what the fuck happened to Bill Sims?
Do you have a dark curiosity? Follow and listen to Heart Starts Pounding on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Where are his bones?
I was hoping you'd tell me, Dottie said, dumping extra sugar into her coffee. Harvey was quiet. Harvey was never quiet. He had a delightfully sick sense of humor that was needed in his profession. He would tell you as much. When you have to stare at death every day, you're going to need to learn how to laugh at the absurdity of life. Otherwise, you won't have much of a life to live. That, combined with his collection of rare scotch, made him a premier party host in the town of Dorset. Harvey walked over towards the one solitary window, opened it, and then took out a cigarette. The last cigarette of a pack that seemed old. He lit the cigarette and exhaled deeply. You okay, Harvey?
I've been doing this for damn near 45 years, and I've never seen anything like this before.
Dottie sat nearby the examination table, lingering hangover still lingering. She sipped her coffee and tried to press an answer out of him. Come on, Harvey. Give me something. Anything. There's gotta be an explanation.
Dottie, the human body doesn't burn like this. Heat destroys the muscles, charring and exposing the bone. This is just skin. Melted skin. Where the hell are his bones?
Probably with the lunatic who burned him, Murph said, leaning in for another gross inspection.
Humans aren't pizzas. You can't just wipe the cheese off, Harvey added.
There goes your pizza theory, Murph. Murph covered his mouth, nauseous from the smell. I'll be right, he said through his hands, darting out of the room in sweats. My report is gonna look like gibberish. There's gotta be an explanation. Maybe he...
He what, Dottie? Defied everything we know about biochemistry? That's a lot. Even for a prick like Bill Sims. Frankly, it's a medical marvel.
Yeah, marvelous. If you're stumped, what chance do I got? Dottie asked, shaking her head. Who else can I ask? You gotta know someone.
A priest?
Harvey said, only half-kidding. Shit. Dottie slouched in her chair, wincing at the smell.
Simmy was no angel, but you don't think someone...
Harvey let the question end itself. Even if we did, Harvey, it don't explain that.
No,
Harvey said, taking another drag and then blowing the smoke out the window.
No, it don't. Oh, happy birthday, Dottie,
Harvey said, raising his cup of coffee.
The big 4-0.
Yeah, happy fucking birthday. Larry was getting lucky. It had been a while. Technically, he had gotten lucky on Labor Day, but he paid for it. A detail which he left out in the summary of how his night ended when he recounted it for his friends the next day to some applause. He didn't know that she was on the clock, so to speak, but when she told him how much it would cost for him to get into the cab with him, he did some quick drunk calculations in his head and realized it would cost him about a week's pay for a night's work with Lucy. Lucy was way out of his league, so he had two options. Say farewell to Lucy, go back into the bar and tell his friend she was a prostitute, or he could bring her to the local motel for what turned out to be about 15 seconds of bliss, followed by passing out. Lucy, God bless her, only took half of what they had negotiated. Not that he would have even noticed considering how drunk he was during their brief time together. When he woke up and saw the condom, he knew there was at least a good chance he had actually gotten lucky. Even if the particulars weren't in his favor, but tonight, he was getting lucky the old-fashioned way. Larry was on the wrong side of 40. He had never had a real girlfriend, and his prospects weren't exactly on the up and up as his weight gain and his hair loss seemed to be competing for who could make him less attractive. Compound that with his job as manager at Tens, the local bowling alley which had seen a dip in attendance ever since a strip club two towns over, also called Tens, opened up to much more commercial acclaim. It was the only strip club within 30 miles, and it put a big damper into the enthusiasm for bowling. Hordes of men dealing with quarter, mid, and end-of-life crises now had an additional outlet to drown their sorrows with. Even Larry would frequent from time to time when he had enough money for a lap dance or two. As nice as it was to look at some of these ladies, it was taking a toll on Larry's wallet. He got the night shift at Tens, the bowling alley, not the commercially acclaimed strip club, as a favor from his cousin. But if things didn't pick up, his cousin would have to work nights too, just to make ends meet. The solution to all of Larry's problems whenever he was in a pinch was to get blitzed at Mort's. He could walk there from the bowling alley, which was key since he had lost his car after his third DWI. It was on this random Thursday night where she had walked in. Talk about a record scratch. Alyssa. She was a bombshell. Fire red hair, piercing brown eyes.
"I didn't know brown could be a nice color,"
Larry said at one point, trying to be romantic. She could have sat down next to anyone inside the bar. And by anyone, Larry meant either him or Gus, the Vietnam vet who literally had his name on a chair by this point. But she chose Larry, an easy mark he assumed at first. So did Gus. Girls like Alyssa did not come into places like Mort's. Mort's. The name said it all. You walked in and immediately needed a beer. Brilliance on the part of the architect. Constructing a place so depressing you needed to immediately drown out your reality through large volumes of alcohol. Betsy, the bartender, was giving her the stink eye all night. Betsy was a larger lady who loved to show off her skin. She got good tips and might give you a tug out back if she was feeling low.
"Careful, Larry," Betsy said while Alyssa was in the bathroom. "It's the nice girls you gotta wear extra rubbers for. Clean ain't always clean."
This didn't faze Larry. In fact, it was only after Betsy brought up the notion of sexually transmitted diseases did Larry realize he might actually be having sex tonight. Still, the question remained. Could he afford it? No. Not if he was going to be able to pay rent next month. Larry leaned into Alyssa and said,
"You're a beautiful girl, but I'm sorry, hun. I can't afford you."
Alyssa, with her radiant face, tilted her head and smiled.
"Oh, you think I want your money?"
"Well, don't you?"
Larry asked, sincerely. Alyssa laughed and then ordered them another round of Black Dogs on tap.
"I don't want your money, Larry. Would I come into Mort's if I was looking for money?"
Touché, Larry thought.
So that would mean she wanted Larry for Larry? He was nervous, hence the three too many rounds of Black Dogs. Around round five, she told him to pump the brakes. Otherwise, he wasn't going to survive the next step in their relationship.
"Next up?" he asked.
"Take a guess, Larry."
Larry usually drank to make the women he spoke to more attractive. A social tactic as old as time itself. But Alyssa was already stunning. And young.
"How old are you?"
he asked through a tornado of slurred speech.
"Old enough, Larry. Let's just say I've got some daddy issues I'm looking to work out. Think you can help me out with that?"
"Check, please," Larry shouted.
She held his hand during the cab ride, which she paid for. Holy mother of shit was the only thing running through his head during the entire drive. Ditto for the cab driver. Not so much that Larry was with the girl, but that Larry could afford to be with the girl. Freddie was a well-known cabbie around town, and he had never seen a girl like Alyssa in Dorset, or anywhere for that matter. Freddie needed something to take the edge off after the drop-off. Larry was about to score with a 10. Meanwhile, Freddie was headed back home to a 4.
"Well, if you add us up, we're an 8.
Freddie once said while on a double date, which led his bride to smash the side of Freddie's face with a full Pabst Blue Ribbon can. This weekend was their 12-year anniversary. He needed a hit of his homegrown weed to help balance out the boiling jealousy of lucky Larry. He pulled off to the side of the road with his lights off, tucked away so nobody could see his cab between the two pickup trucks and his worn-down industrial side street, and then lit his blunt while turning up his Best of Bruce mix CD. Philadelphia was the Bruce jam Freddie had been feeling lately. It was great for driving around town when he was alone, or pulled off to the side of a dark road to smoke a homemade blunt. He had dreams of getting out of Dorset too, opening up his own transportation business, only for celebrities.
Cream of the top.
was the name in his head. It would focus on luxurious transportation for the elite. He rubbed the crucifix dangling around his rearview mirror for good luck. The more he listened to Bruce Springsteen sing about Philadelphia, the more he started to believe Philly was a good place for his new business. Not too far from where he was, but far enough to feel like a fresh start. That's when he started to smell it. Smoke. But not his smoke. His smoke was comforting. This was bad smoke. He turned. Left. Right. The hell was that? He searched his back seat. He searched himself. It wasn't the car. It wasn't him. And then, in the rearview mirror, he saw something.
Oh, shit!
He said out loud. Freddy got out of the car. The tiny apartment above the laundromat, the tiny apartment that belonged to Larry, was on fire. Well, just the inside. As Freddy walked closer to the building, he could see a raging fire burning through both windows. But it didn't seem to be catching on to the rest of the property. The fire was contained from inside, as dark black smoke shot out of both tiny windows up into the dark sky. The smoke was so strong, Freddy swore it was as if it was scraping against the wind, as if nature could whisper, frantic, illegible whispers. A blast of red smoke shot through the gate, knocking Freddy to the ground. He lay on the snowy sidewalk in a daze. Whispers of the wind became louder and more frantic, as if there were people all around Freddy speaking over each other in a language he couldn't understand, until a figure walked over him. It was dark, covered in a cloak, with a black robe draped over the mysterious figure's head. They knelt down right above Freddy as he covered his face, crying with tears of panic, holding up his crucifix while yelling,
"I'm just a limo driver!"
And then silence. No more whispers, no more smoke, no more mysterious figure standing above him. Just Freddy.
What if everything you learn in history class was only half the story? I'm Dr. Harini Bhatt, host of Hidden History. Every Monday, I go where history gets mysterious. Vanished civilizations, doomsday prophecies, paranormal phenomena, and events that science still can't fully explain. On Hidden History, I treat these moments like open case files. Not myths, not superstition, just incomplete explanations waiting for a closer look. Listen to and follow Hidden History, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Or I could go fuck myself.
What?
Freddy asked. Well, you just gave me two options, Dottie said from behind the interrogation table. I could either believe the story you just told me, or I could go fuck myself.
I'm kinda leaning towards option number two, cause it's way more realistic, Freddy.
I'm telling the truth, Dottie. You gotta believe me.
Freddy was sitting in the interrogation room, a room which had rarely been used, seeing how Dorset was not exactly the hub of towns requiring interrogations. The last time this room had been used was about 3 years ago when a local idiot named Roman was arrested for protesting outside of an elementary school graduation. He was adamant that aliens were invading the Earth and that children were the mediums used to spread their galactic propaganda. It was actually Roman's idea to be interrogated and given a lie detector test, to prove that his story about being abducted in the woods was not a hoax. Dottie made Murph give him the lie detector test, which proved nothing. Lie detector tests since then have widely been uncovered to be totally unreliable means for questioning. Yet Roman insisted that this was all the proof he needed to show the world that our time as rulers of this Earth was coming to an end. He's currently the manager at Redline Video, which has been ticketed multiple times for selling illicit videotapes outside of operating hours.
Why would I make this up, Dottie?
Dottie and Murph were sitting across from Freddy.
Beats the hell out of me. But if you're gonna tug my nuts with some bullshit story, could you at least make the story plausible?
I don't even know what you just said to me. He said that a raging fire that whispered to him from inside Larry's apartment.
I know what he said, Murph. I wasn't being literal,
Dottie told Murph, shaking her head as she got up to pace around the 10x12 interrogation room.
Sorry, Murph said as he closed his notebook.
Dot, I got no beef with Larry. I got no beef with anybody. Think about it. You really think I'm smart enough to light a guy on fire without leaving any evidence?
He had a point, Dottie thought.
You've got a point, Murph said out loud.
And look at the body. You saw it? I saw it. We all saw it.
How the hell was the skin just ripped off like that?
You think I could pull something like that off? I'm an idiot, Dottie.
True, you are an idiot, Dottie agreed out loud.
Thank you, Freddy agreeingly confirmed as he sipped the apple juice they bought him when they first walked into the room. I'm gonna grab another coffee. You good, Murph?
Hey, Dot. Murph walked up to Dottie and in a low volume asked, Do you want to go home for a little bit? Take a nap? You haven't stopped working since.
I'm good, Murph.
Thanks, though.
Actually, go talk to Betsy at Mort's. If Larry was really getting lucky, we need to find the girl.
Will do, Sarge, Murph said as he opened the door.
Another apple juice. Please,
Freddy said, slouching into a seat. Dottie was filling a fresh cup of coffee when Sandy, the dolled-up dispatch, wearing her usual assortment of rings and jewelry, asked from nearby at her desk.
Hey, Dot, was it Freddy?
Don't think so, Sandy. Because he's too stupid, right?
Among other things, Dottie said, sipping her fresh cup of coffee.
So who do you think did it?
If I tell you, Sandy, you promise not to tell your brother, then half the town?
On my life, Dottie, I swear.
Dottie smiled, knowing that meant nothing. Sandy was the biggest gossip in town, which normally didn't matter since gossip about who banged who or who stole which keg of booze from whoever's town league softball game had very little stakes.
I'll keep you posted, hon, Dottie said, walking back down the narrow hallway towards the interrogation room with her coffee.
Standing outside the room, staring in through the tiny window, was Captain Collins. Collins was nearing 60, with a protruding gut, shaved head, and thick glasses, like a character out of an Elmore Leonard novel. He had a very distinct manner of speaking. He would take periodic long pauses while speaking as if he was lost in someone else's thoughts. But when he did start speaking, you listened, because he didn't waste words.
Hey, Cap. Good to see ya.
What's good about it?
Collins shook his head as he sipped his cup of steaming herbal tea. His doctor had told him to cut the caffeine a couple years back after he got so worked up during a pep rally that he fainted and had to be hospitalized overnight.
We haven't had a homicide since 1985, and now we got two within 36 hours.
Me and Murph can debrief you on our intel so far, Cap, when Murph gets back.
Where's Murph?
Talking to Betts over at Mort's to verify that Larry was seen leaving with a girl that night.
Larry? With a lady?
That's what Murph's gonna find out, Cap.
Maybe she was a lady. Of the night.
It's a definite possibility, Cap.
Well, it sure as shit wasn't Freddy. He's had a leak in his attic since he was 5. Got his pecker stuck in a vacuum cleaner once. His mother's vacuum cleaner. What kind of sick dick does that?
Freddy.
When's the last time you slept, Deacons? You look like shit.
I'm good, Cap. Fresh as rain.
We're gonna have to speak to the press.
Collins sipped his tea and then smacked his lips.
Mayor has been on my ass all morning. Can't hold him off any longer. People are gonna panic. Let's plan for this afternoon. 3 p.m.
Sounds good, Cap.
Collins started to leave until Dottie asked, Should we let Freddy go?
Keep him another hour. Vacuum cleaner. Sick dick.
Collins shook his head while walking away.
A girl. With Larry?
Correct, Betts. Murph was now sitting at the bar. The only other person inside was Gus, who was passed out into a bowl of peanuts.
Nah, he wasn't with a girl. He said he was with a girl?
Correct, Betts. Can you corroborate that statement?
Corroborate what now?
Can you confirm if Larry was alone when he left here last night?
Of course he was alone. It's Larry. Why, what'd that tub of grub do now?
He's... Murph had never had to inform someone before.
He's dead, Betsy. Larry?
Yes.
But... how?
That's what we're trying to figure out, Betsy. Did anyone have any qualms with Larry?
Qualms? The fuck is a qualm, Murph? Stop using big words.
Did anyone have any issues with Larry that you were aware of?
Heck no. Larry was a loser. What's there to get mad at Larry for?
That's what we're trying to uncover, Betsy. It's a peculiar set of circumstances, to say the least.
Shit. He was my best customer. Not counting Gus. Gus? You still with us?
Gus raised his thumbs up while the rest of his body remained passed out at the bar.
I come in peace.
Oh, I need this like a bag of dicks in my Christmas stocking, Dottie said as she walked towards her cop car in the parking lot.
Sergeant, I come in peace, only to serve you and help with the investigation.
I come in peace. Isn't that what the alien said when they abducted you, Roman?
Standing near her car was Roman. He was in his mid to late 40s, slender, with a mustache, sunglasses, flannel hunting hat, wearing a custom duster with the words Believe What You See down the left and right sides, topped off with big black boots.
Sarge, I know we've had our differences, but I can help you.
Roman, you've got to the count of three to get away from me, or I'm going to shoot you in the dick.
Hey, you can't threaten me.
Tell it to the men in black. One.
Sarge. Two. Sarge, just...
Three.
Okay. I'm backing off.
Thank you. Dottie opened her door until...
Just take this.
Roman removed a folder tucked into his duster and held it up.
Just take it, and you never have to see me again.
I've heard that before.
I know you got no leads, Dottie.
Can't hurt.
That's all I'm saying. Can't hurt.
Under her breath, Dottie muttered, Roman, and took a deep sigh.
I'll leave it here for you to browse.
Roman left the folder on Dottie's hood, and then took several steps backwards.
I believe in collaborating investigations, Sergeant.
This isn't a collaboration, Roman. I'm a police officer, and you're a Looney Tune.
I passed that lie detector test, Dottie. It's in the public record.
Lie detectors are a scam, Roman.
You're upset with me because our friendship never blossomed into a romance. I understand.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Dottie grabbed the folder and placed it under her armpit before hopping into her car.
It's not that I don't find you attractive, Dottie. I think we'd be very compatible.
Dottie peeled out of the parking lot as her tires spit ice up into the air onto Roman's boots.
The last thing we want is panic, Captain.
I agree, Mr. Mayor.
Collins was now sitting behind his desk as Mayor Wilson paced around the opposite side of Collins' office, smoking a cigarette. Mayor Wilson was in his mid to late 50s, clean as a whistle, with almost impossibly wavy hair, wearing his bright blue tie under his very dark blue suit jacket. He had pearl-white teeth and was a bit too tan considering the gloomy winter surroundings of his town. Dorset is renowned for its peace and tranquility. I'll be damned if I'm going to let a couple bad apples ruin an entire farm. Not to mention, but it is worth mentioning, this is the spooky season, Collins. You know how much business we get the month of October.
I do, Mr. Mayor.
So we need to confront this head on. We will be honest with the people. We will let them know there is nothing to be concerned about. Nothing at all. You what, Collins?
I want to agree, Mr. Mayor. But at this present time, we have no suspects. And to the best of my knowledge, we have no medical evidence to support a hypothesis regarding how the deceased were killed.
Have you spoken with Harvey?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. He classified it as a medical marvel.
Medical marvel? What the hell does that mean?
It means exactly that, sir. He is at a loss.
Well, we're all going to be at a loss if our town turns into hysterics. How will it look if the month leading up to the election is marred over some bizarre gas stove incidents?
Gas stove incidents?
Surely you've looked into the stoves, Collins? Why, you know how dicey those stoves can be. The first fella and the second fella probably had some faulty wiring in the electricals. There's nothing medically marvelous about that, is there, Collins?
But wouldn't the property burn, in addition to the bodies?
I'm not an engineer, Collins. I don't know how wires work. Point is, we need to start thinking logically before the town starts wearing aluminum hats and shoving crystals up their butts. Do we understand each other, Collins?
We do. I just...
That's the story, Collins. Until we have a more logical conclusion. And don't you worry. I'm going to give the electrical company a piece of my own mind, I'll have you know. Nobody gets fried in my town and gets to keep their silver slippers. You better believe that, Collins.
Yes, sir.
Very well.
Wilson put his half-smoked cigarette towards what he is trying to find of an ashtray. Collins offers up his coffee cup.
I'll confer with you and your team after the press conference. Whatever resources you need, Collins, I will provide.
Mayor Wilson flashed his trademark smile and walked out of the room. Collins looked down at the cigarette floating on his coffee. An apt metaphor, if there was one.
I'm Dana Carvey.
I'm David Spade.
Fly on the Wall's back for another season now on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
So many incredible guests will be joining us.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Too good to be true.
Spontaneous combustion.
Jesus, Ma. You scared the hell out of me.
Dottie said, clutching her chest as she opened the front screen door to her mother's house.
Look, it's right here.
Standing in the doorway in her New England Patriots robe and slippers was Dottie's mom, Carissa.
Spontaneous combustion can occur when a substance with a relatively low ignition temperature, hay, straw, peat, etc., begins to release heat.
A husky, darts past Dottie out of the house.
Husky got out. He does that, he'll be fine. Listen, this may occur in several ways, either by oxidation in the presence of moisture and air, bacterial fermentation which generates heat.
Did you eat yet, Ma?
Dottie is walking towards the kitchen, followed by Carissa, who continues to read from her medical journal magazine.
The heat is unable to escape hay, straw, peat, etc., our good thermal insulators, and the temperature of the material rises above its ignition point, even though much of the bacteria are destroyed by ignition temperatures.
I can't stay long, Ma. I gotta get back.
Combustion begins if sufficient oxidizer, such as oxygen and fuel, are present to maintain the reaction into a thermal runway.
Dottie opens the fridge, which is packed to the brim.
Jesus, Ma. You planning for the apocalypse?
Well, can you blame me?
Carissa exclaims, lightly smacking Dottie's shoulder with the magazine.
Jesus, Ma, Dottie said, grabbing a beer.
We've got spontaneous combustion, at Dorset of all places.
Would you settle down, please? I told you to stop watching all the science fiction movies,
Dottie told her as she got out her Tupperware container of mac and cheese.
Rita, down at the salon, says it's spontaneous combustion.
Rita from the salon? Ma, the hell are you listening to Rita for?
She's a barber, not a scientist. Dottie put the mac and cheese in the microwave.
Okay, so what are your theories, Mrs. Police Officer? What the hell happened to Sims?
I'll tell you one thing. It wasn't spontaneous combustion that lit them up.
Them? There's more than one?
Carissa clutched her literal plastic pearls.
Oh, Jesus, Ma.
This is end of time shit, Dottie.
Two guys, Ma. Two.
Within 36 hours.
Ma, settle down. Where's your cookies? Have a cookie.
I don't want a cookie. I'm calling your cousin Eddie. We're building a bunker.
Ma, don't call cousin.
The microwave started beeping. Dottie opened it and then sat down at the small dining table. It was next to a large open sliding door that looked onto a lovely now covered in snow backyard. Beyond the backyard, several streets down, were woods. Dottie took a deep breath and finally scooped up a forkful of mac and cheese. Until she felt something underneath her armpit. One of the papers Roman had given her was still in her jacket. "Believe what you see," was inscribed onto the top of the folder. Dottie opened it up and saw the first page with the headline, "Wiccans." Below that were hand-drawn pictures of naked women dancing together around a large open fire in the middle of dense, dark woods.
Sick prick,
Dottie muttered under her breath. She cracked open the beer and sipped, her eyes never wavering from the paper. Heard shouting from the second floor was,
Dottie!
What, Ma?
Eddie wants to know how big your bunker should be.
Dottie collapsed her face onto the table.
Dottie! How big, Eddie said.
Dottie covered the back of her head with her big Dorset police jacket. Second body discovered this morning. Ongoing investigation. That was the headline on the screen as Captain Collins stood at the podium giving a statement in front of flashing lights surrounded by Mayor Wilson and his security detail. Watching this on his TV was Lime, while Cody was under his feet devouring a fresh bone. Lime was spinning a tiny Boston College football in his hand to help him think. It was a move he had done his entire career. The football had lived for decades in his office. He left it behind while moving out, on purpose, hoping it would bring good fortune to his replacement, Collins. But Collins and everyone else felt like it had to stay with Lime, so they gave it back. It had been resting comfortably on his mantle for nearly 9 years. Until now.
No reason for panic.
The line jumped out of the TV screen and stared him dead between the eyes. Lime stood up. He got his big winter coat, his big winter hat, his big winter boots, and his big winter gun. It was a retirement gift from the whole Dorset police unit, placed securely into a big shiny box that, without knowing better, you would have thought it contained an array of chocolates. He had secretly hoped to never have to open the box. He had secretly hoped he could give it to his son when he retired. He had secretly hoped that the past would never again become the present. Inside this box was a Smith & Wesson Model 500 with compensator.
You're stepping on the foreskin.
What? Murph said, looking down at remnants of skin dripping off the examination table as he quickly backed up away from it. Harvey was pointing to where Murph had been standing.
That's the foreskin. Well, it was the foreskin. It's sequential. The skin padded. It goes perfectly in line from his head all the way to his toes. Look, here's the head. You could tell from the hair pattern.
Harvey, it's dripping off the table. Murph covered his mouth, nauseous.
It hasn't cooled yet. Like a Carvel ice cream that's been out in the fridge too long.
Wow, there goes ever having Carvel ice cream cake again. Thanks, Doc,
Dottie said, burying her face into her hands as she sat down.
Can't you cool it down so it doesn't melt and drip?
That would defeat the purpose of an autopsy, Murph. Never interfere with nature,
Harvey said as he inspected the skin under his medical lens.
Truly, it's a medical marvel.
Please stop saying medical marvel, Harvey. For me, pretty please, with sugar on top.
I watched the press conference today, Dottie, as I imagine the entire town did. The sooner the bear and everyone else comes to grip with the reality of the situation, the sooner we may be able to solve it.
Solve what, Harvey? Nobody has a damn clue what the hell this is.
Well, it sure as hell isn't faulty stoves.
Yeah, I know. Trust me.
No connections between the two deceased?
Both 40. Lived alone.
You're 40 and live alone, Dottie.
Thanks, Murph.
Sorry, Dottie.
My mother thinks it's spontaneous combustion.
That's more likely than faulty stoves,
Harvey added before having to take off his skin-drenched medical gloves to toss them into the trash can.
Murph, go talk to Larry's cousin.
Patrick?
Yeah, poke around the bowling alley. See if he knows anything.
Did Larry have enemies? Whatever you can get, okay?
Will do.
Murph turned to walk out, checked under his boots, and then walked out of the room.
I thought you were going out of town for the big 4-0.
I was gonna, but flights were too pricey. I'll go away during the holidays.
Gotta get out there, Dottie, while you're young.
I will. Trust me.
I will,
Dottie said, walking over towards the window to look at the seemingly infinite gray clouds hovering above the town.
Wanna get a laugh? The last thing I remember from the other night, hanging at 85, I was telling the guys how nice it'd be to get a little action.
Ask and ye shall receive.
Yeah,
Dottie said, unleashing a tiny laugh. The S was out. Now the bowling alley 10s just looked like 10. Murph got out of the car and had to bundle up. Every step he took was cautious. The parking lot was covered with black ice, and you could tell by the density of his breath that it was below zero. He was relieved to finally get to the front door until...
Hey, Murph!
Murph turned and immediately slipped onto his back. Running over to stand above him was Patrick.
You okay, Murph?
Murph condemned him while laying on the icy ground.
Salt the pathway, Patrick.
I was just about to, Murph. I swear it. On my mother's grave.
Oh, I could ticket you.
Ah, please, Murph. I'll do it right now. I swear. I mean, I gotta get the salt bags. Business has been slow, as you can see. And with my cousin dying and everything, I haven't really had time to, you know, not grieve. But I'll do it pronto, buddy. I swear it.
Sorry about your cousin, Patrick.
Thanks, Murph.
There was a brief pause. Murph was still lying on the ground. Can you help me up?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Patrick had a skinny mustache and comb over with a smile that always felt greasy. He stuck out his lanky arm to help Murph stand up. Bowling pins popped in the background as the bowling ball sailed through them. Speaking in the tiny office located behind the bar was Murph, with his notepad and pen, as Patrick spoke. You and Larry were close, right?
Oh, heck yeah. Thick as thieves.
Did you know about his porn collection?
Well, we weren't that close. I mean, second cousins. Does that even count as family?
Did Larry have enemies, Pat?
Enemies? Oh, shoot. Larry didn't have enemies. He was a teddy bear, Murph. You know that.
Patrick said while chewing gum at a sprinter's pace.
I'll tell you who you should look into. Ken's. That new strip club? They got some weasels down there, Murph.
Yeah?
I'd give them a good look up and down, if you know what I mean. Wouldn't shock me if I found they was connected to all this somehow.
If you know something, Pat, now's the time to tell me. If we find out something down the road...
I wouldn't jerk you around, Murph. I want to find the son of a gun who did this just as bad as you do.
Trust me. Take vengeance into my own hands, you know? Bronson style. Take my card, Pat. You think of something? I mean anything. You call me. Okay?
Dead, Murph. You find out something, let me know. We can combine forces and whatnot.
Murph put his winter hat back on and stood up as Patrick took the card sitting on his tiny desk in this 8x8 space packed to the brim with folders, loose papers, receipts, and one giant blinding lamp.
You let the boys in blue know if they need extra muscle, give old Pat a call. This is my family, Murph.
All right, Pat, Murph said, standing up. Sorry for your loss. Patrick nodded as Murph walked out. He waited a couple of seconds until he heard the front door close, and then took out a small vial, poured it onto his desk, and then snorted the entire line. Like a jolt of lightning, he snapped back into focus and then clicked his mouse, which immediately led to sounds of girls moaning. Tens, or rather, 10 lights shut off outside, as did all the lights inside, minus one soft light still on in the doorway heading outside. As Patrick walked out into the empty parking lot, he lit a cigarette with his shivering hands. Right as he got to the door of his tan-trimmed 1976 Chevy Suburban.
Excuse me? Do you have a phone inside I could use?
What's that?
Standing there was Alyssa, wearing the same clothing she had worn the previous night with Larry, still looking radiant, completely unaffected by the brutal cold. Her skin seemed incapable of not emanating a glow.
I'm sorry to bother you. My car broke down up the road. I was hoping you could help me call a cab. I just need to get back to town.
Oh, shoot. You know, truth be told, this time of night, this weather, odds of getting a cab are real slim.
Oh, no. Well, thank you anyway,
Alyssa said, starting to walk away.
Hey,
Pat yelled, turning her around.
I'll give you a lift.
Are you sure? I would hate to be a bother.
Bother? Course not. Anything for a damsel in distress. Come on, head on in.
Pat said, running around to open the passenger side door for Alyssa.
You're my hero.
Guilty as charged, ma'am,
Patrick said, unleashing his patented sleaze smile. Alyssa got inside the car, and then so too did Pat.
Name's Pat, by the way.
My name is Alyssa.
Alyssa? Lovely name. Is that English?
Patrick tried to make small talk as his engine fizzled.
No, Scottish? You got that red hair. Shoot, that is red. Real red. I love redheads.
The engine continued to stall.
Sometimes she takes a minute to get warmed up.
Women.
Something startled Patrick.
Holy smokes. You got friends, huh?
Outside his car, forming a circle, were a row of women wearing cloaks, hoods draped over their foreheads, covering their eyes.
Holy smokes. Got enough for a bowling team. You know, we offer discounts for lady teams.
Alyssa took Patrick's hand. He looked down. Her hand was old and withered. Frail. He turned to look back up at Alyssa.
Ah!
He screamed. Alyssa had black eyes, yellow, seething, bloody teeth. Her complexion was white and frail. Unleashing a maniacal laugh, the surrounding women took a step closer and put their hands onto the car, joined together by their rapid, shared, illegible speech patterns. Larry's body started to shake, violently, as if someone had turned his body temperature all the way to its boiling point. His eyes popped out of his skull. Blood leaked out of every orifice. He tried to scream, but his mouth melted off his jawbone. Larry's entire body began to melt as his skin dripped like candle wax down onto his interior. His back seats were now slowly covering in black ash. His bubbling skin seeped through the crevices of his car door, spewing out onto the black ice. When the final mutated gurgling noises of Larry's horrific screams ended, silence. The women were gone. Alyssa, as beautiful and radiant as ever, casually opened the door,
put her red hoodie up over her forehead, and strolled away into the endless night.
The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.